I have a new retro gaming device that might pique your interest.
It definitely sounds like something I would be interested in.
Tell us more, Mark.
It's called an Evercade.
Okay, so Alan recognises these words, but I don't. What is an Evercade?
So Evercade is, it started off as one device, but it's now like a platform for retro gaming, which is available in several form factors. They do handhelds, they do a home console, and they do mini cabinets. And they publish properly licensed, re-released retro games on physical cartridges. And all of their systems support the same cartridges.
Oh my gosh, there's a lot to unpack here. So handheld, console, and mini stand-up cabinets or whatever.
Yeah, sort of desktop cabinets.
And these are original titles from the past.
Yeah, mostly. There's a few sort of like newer indie titles or games which people have developed for retro systems.
Right.
But a lot of them are collections of, they do three sort of categories. They do arcade games, as the name suggests, and they do console games, and they do home computer games.
Is it FPGA based? Is it emulation? How does this thing work? How does it emulate multiple different things?
I believe it's emulation. The term pixel perfect emulation appears on their website, so I assume that's what it is. It's not faffing around with emulators. You don't have to find like BIOS images and ROMs and stuff. You buy a game on a cartridge and you plug it in and then you select it from the menu and it plays.
Okay, before we get into more details, why did you choose to get one of these?
Well, it's because there is a particular system for which there are several collections of games available, which is the Commodore Amiga.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first computer growing up. My dad had a Commodore Amiga for basically because he's a surveyor and he used CAD packages. Mm-hmm. But it also meant that we had boxes and boxes of floppy disks of games, mainly cover disks. So there's lots of like demos of games which I've played, but I didn't necessarily as a kid have access to the full game.
Right.
But they've released collections from, I think, three or four different publishers of Amiga games, which I thought would be worth getting.
So for Amiga games, I would imagine in order to be authentic, either they support keyboard and mouse and joystick, or they eschew that and only support the joystick-based games. How does the interface work to the games?
I think for the games that I've been playing, they were games which you would have played with a joystick, but there are occasionally screens like when you enter your name in the high score table where you need to type. So for that, you press select and you get an on-screen keyboard.
Oh, nice.
You then type with the D-pad and the button. But yes, these are games which you would have played with the joystick, I think. There haven't been any which would be a keyboard and mouse type game that I've come across yet. I mean, you could either play them with a keyboard or a joystick, but it's like up, down, left, right, and space bar if you were playing with the keyboard.
You mentioned something about cartridges. Now, as my memory is that Amiga games mostly came on like blue floppy disks. So
yes.
How do you buy these things? How do you acquire them? And like what do they retail for?
Is it a box of 10 floppy disks? Is that what you buy?
Yeah, you don't have to get a load of cartridges and like load one, wait for it to like load what's on that one and then swap for the next one. No, so you get so the ones I've got two collections by the Bitmap Brothers and one collection by Team 17.
Oh.
And each of them has about half a dozen games on. And I think they retail for somewhere between £15 and £20 each. And I got them used for a bit cheaper than that.
The Evercade has been around a while. This whole system has been around a while. So I wondered if you'd picked it up secondhand or whether you got it new. I didn't know if there were new developments in the Evercade ecosystem, as it were.
Yeah, so, I mean, they have revved the hardware a few times. The original Evercade was the first handheld. Then there's the Evercade EXP, which was the successor to that. And now they have the Versus, which is the home console. I think the Alpha is the cabinet. And they've now got the EXP-R and the Versus R, which are the newer generation. But I went for the Evercade EXP secondhand because two reasons. One, it comes with some games built in, which the newer one doesn't, for licensing reasons, essentially, because they were looking to cut down on the cost of the unit. And also, it has an HDMI out port, which means you can plug it into your telly.
What does it render at?
I believe if you plug it into the TV, it renders at 720p. And I don't know what it renders on the internal screen, possibly the same thing.
Oh, wait, what? Internal screen? Sorry, I missed that bit. I thought this was a box you plug into the telly.
No, so the one I've got, the Evercade EXP, is the handheld.
Ah,
but
okay.
It also has HDMI out. So like I do with the Steam Deck, I can sit on my sofa and plug it into the TV and play like that.
So you've chosen wisely with titles from Team 17 and the Bitmap Brothers, but like, what else is available? Is it just home computer systems, or what era? Does it go back to the 8-bit stuff? Does it go further forward than the Amiga?
Yeah, so it goes back to rubbish like the C64.
Cheeky git.
Agreed.
But there's also some console collections. So they do a Tomb Raider cartridge. So there's PlayStation. I think that's probably the sort of most modern console it emulates. And there's also quite a lot of arcade collections. So, Alan, I think there's R-Type available.
Don't make me buy it again on yet another platform. Although I did donate. If anyone fancies having a play of my R-Type, go to see the RMC cave, because you might find it available there to play with. I don't know.
And they actually kind of gamify this, because each of the cartridges are numbered. And when you load a cartridge in, it tells you how many games you've collected out of all of those that are available to try and, gamify you into getting more. The one that I got came with a load of Capcom arcade games.
Oh, nice.
Preloaded as well. So there's things like Street Fighter 2 and Bionic Commando is one I was interested in, because that's one I had on the Amiga, but I was never very good at.
Is there a way to, in inverted commas, sideload floppy disks into this? Or like, if you went in your father's loft and found a bunch of Amiga games, could you get them into this Evercade somehow?
There is a project, I can't remember what it's called now, but there is a project to patch the firmware and run your own games and emulators off an SD card cartridge, essentially. I think it's a Linux-based system underneath, so you can actually run RetroArch that way if you really wanted to. I'm not looking at going down that route, because I could have done this on my Steam Deck with RetroArch if I'd wanted. Mm. I got this because I wanted a nice plug-and-play solution. And it's a lot more portable than a Steam Deck as well. So it's something I could sort of take with me going away much more easily.
I used to run RetroDeck on my Steam Deck before I got rid of my Steam Deck. And that really is plug-and-play. Once you put the ROMs on there, you are diving straight into games. So it's a very compelling user interface to play old games. But I do love this idea of having a piece of physical hardware that's like dedicated to the retro games that you liked when you were younger.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. And you mentioned taking games on the go. So what's the sort of, battery endurance like if you're, out on the rounds with your portable games machine from the past?
I'd say that's probably one of the two negatives I've found so far, is the battery isn't amazing. I don't know if this is because I've bought a used unit, though. I mean, they say, I think, 3 to 4 hours on this model, but I'm probably getting more like 2, 2.5. But it depends what you're playing as well. Mm-hmm.
It's about right for a Linux laptop, isn't it?
Yeah. The other negative that, it's a personal thing, really. I'm not a massive fan of the D-pad on it. So they've gone with a sort of a Mega Drive style D-pad where the whole thing's sort of floating, which isn't my favorite. Feels a bit like, once you're really hammering on it, it feels a bit wibbly wobbly. Mm-hmm. But it's not unresponsive. It's fine. Some people like that sort of thing. I'm a Nintendo boy, so I like the more solid cross-shaped D-pad myself.
So when you've got it plugged into the HDMI into your telly, can you pair a controller over Bluetooth or plug one in?
No. So this unit is a solo gaming device.
Right.
The Versus supports two controllers, and I think the cabinets do as well. So they have USB controllers which plug in for that use case. So many of the games support two players, but on the handheld, they're only one player.
Well, I had never heard of the Evercade. I don't know how this has passed me by, but it's a few months until my birthday. I think I know what I'm going to be asking for my birthday to stick under the TV in the front room.
And then we'll get competition between the two of you as to how many games you've loaded into your Evercade.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm going to be with Mark here. There's going to be a few choice studios from the past who I would want to revisit their collection of games. I don't think I'm a Pokemon retro game hunter. I have had this topic on the backlog of things to talk about since before we recorded the very first episode of this podcast. Normally, when we get to talk about things, the things I talk about have been baking for about 6 weeks. This one, about 2.5 years. In fact, longer, because I've been using this bit of software for far longer than it first entered the backlog. So I want to tell you about Maestral, which is an open source Dropbox client that I have been using for years.
How have I never heard about this and you've never mentioned it?
I'm surprised. I'm sure there's lots of our listeners that must have heard about it because it's been around for a long time. So it's called Maestral. And as I say, it is an open source Dropbox client. And there's a number of advantages to using Maestral over the official client.
Wait a minute, rewind. It's a Dropbox client. It's not like Sync thing, which is a completely different thing. This is a thing which is API compatible with Dropbox itself. Is that what you're saying?
It's exactly that. It is.
Right, I understand now.
A unofficial client to the Dropbox service. Now, the reason we got into using this is when lockdown happened and all the schools got thrown into disarray, the schools were throwing all kinds of ad hoc solutions at parents to sort of help educate their children in the chaos that unfolded. And as a result of that, we got back into needing to use Dropbox in order to shuffle homework and, you know, school folders around and what have you. And we'd sacked off Dropbox a few years previous at home. And I installed Dropbox on, and we all run Linux at home. Most of the family run Ubuntu Mate still. And when we installed the Dropbox client, there was a couple of issues. One, the first one was on high DPI displays, the Dropbox client UI just doesn't scale. It looks absolutely tiny. And there's, without sort of exotic workarounds, there's no solution for that. Also, the performance is abysmal. As soon as Dropbox starts, you hear the fans spin up and you also watch all of your memory get consumed. So, you know, the whole experience is a bit poor. And whilst I was Googling around to try and find ways to sort of nice and IO control the Dropbox client, I just happened across Maestral. And the things about Maestral that I like most are: it is memory efficient. It doesn't grind your machine into the ground when it runs through indexing. And the UI on a desktop environment respects HDPI displays just as it does low DPI displays, and has all the facilities of the official client, including things like selective sync and all of that good stuff. So I got into using it through that, but then came to love it for a whole host of different reasons.
What's it written in? What toolkit is it? Is it Rust? Why isn't it Go?
I actually don't know what it's written in. I've had no requirement to ever go and look. I know that it differs from the official Dropbox client in that the way that it works, it talks to the public Dropbox APIs as opposed to whatever the internal, you know, sync services are that, you know, the official client has access to. But in terms of its utility, it's no different from using the official Dropbox client. You know, as a user of this software, it behaves and performs and does the same thing. One of the things you will notice is it's actively maintained. The author is very diligent. There are regular releases and the change logs are detailed in terms of, you know, the things that have been added or improved or fixed.
Python, real-time update. It's Python.
Thank you very much.
Do you know what it's doing differently that allows it to be so much more efficient than the official client?
I have no idea. All I know is that for the years that I've been using it, and it's approaching like 5 years or so now, or maybe longer, it just works and it doesn't like pummel my, because my daughter's and my wife's laptop are not that, they haven't been updated since like 2016 or something. So they're not new. They don't have gobs of RAM. They don't have modern processors in them. So, you know, we're trying to get the most out of them and it just works really well on those machines. And the other reason that I really like it is that unlike the official Dropbox client, which you can use in a headless environment on your NAS and what have you, Maestral has a dedicated purpose-built headless version, which doesn't require any sort of auxiliary utilities in order to authenticate and also do things like selective sync and all of that sort of stuff. So I have the Maestral headless version on the home server, which is constantly, you know, keeping in sync. And that's the version that I back up with Borg backup. So I've got a backup of our Dropbox in case something terrible happens to Dropbox.
Is there anything it can't do?
I think, but I'm not 100% certain, but I think the only thing it doesn't do is it doesn't do LAN syncing.
Okay.
So I think the official client will talk to other Dropbox services on the same LAN in order to synchronize over your LAN, whereas this can only talk to the public APIs, so therefore won't talk to other devices on your network.
I see.
But okay. To be honest with you, we're sharing some spreadsheets and documents. You know, this isn't an issue for us. I imagine if you were sharing...
You've got spare bandwidth.
Yeah, if you were sharing videos or something, then maybe you'd feel differently about it. But for what we use it for, it works just great. So I thought I'd point it out because it's a far better solution than what Dropbox offer. It's available for all of the distributions in all of the places you get your packages from for those distributions. And it works beautifully. I've never had an issue with it.
A small amount of further real-time update. I've gone and found the GitHub repo and issue number 1114. Question, is this repo still actively maintained? Last commit was in September 2024. And the top reply is, does a sync client need to be constantly updated? So there are more words, but that's what it says. But it looks like there are people who like using this. Yeah, I'd never heard of it. But then I stopped using Dropbox, so I switched over to Sync Thing. But yeah, this looks really cool if you're stuck on Dropbox. It's really cool. I created an MCP, MVP, while in a Zoom call I was super underqualified to be in.
Hang on, let's roll back here. An MVP of an MCP. Please unravel the acronyms. What have you made?
Well, first of all, why was I in a meeting that I was unqualified to be in is the first thing. It was a very technical meeting and I had a small amount of input. And, you know, sometimes when you're sitting there and everyone else is really getting stuck in and they're building a specification for a piece of software or they're doing something like very important and very deep and very technical. And you're the, you know, guy who makes the cups of tea on the team.
Drawing cartoons with crayons.
Yeah, exactly. But I actually enjoyed listening into the conversation, but I didn't want to seem completely unproductive. So I busted out my list of things that should exist that don't currently exist, which is my big list of ideas, Alan's big list of ideas. And I started creating an MVP, a minimum viable product, as in something that just about works, of an MCP, which is Model Context Protocol, I believe. So I've been playing around with a bunch of AI stuff recently, as I've mentioned previously, and I know a lot of people don't like or have an opinion about using LLMs for coding and how good or bad they are at the task. Now, one of the things that people seem to think is that an LLM could do anything and you can give any instruction, it'll do anything. But actually, they get a lot better if you farm out some of the tasks to other tools. And that's really what this MCP is. It's a protocol which enables you to offload things that another tool can do better than the LLM. And I'll give you a few examples. One would be searching documentation. Like the LLM that you're currently using, the AI tool that you're currently using, may not have imbibed all of the documentation, the recent documentation for a piece of software. And the software may be fast moving. And so you can use an external tool over this protocol, this MCP protocol, to go and read documentation.
Current documentation.
Yeah, current documentation, up-to-date documentation for any project that you might be interested in developing with, or frameworks, or languages, or whatever. Another one might be just a simple browser search the web, or display web pages, or anything that you wouldn't directly ask the LLM to do that something else can do better. You can offload that task.
So is this a bit like when you have like a Amazon Echo or whatever, and you can write skills for it, which tell it how to take something you say to it and then go and actually do something? It's like that for an LLM. So if you said to an LLM, now I'm trying to think of an example on the fly, but you said to it, you know, use the documentation page on this and blah, blah, blah. And then it goes, oh, now I know what the documentation is on that. I'll do an API request to get that. And then I'll carry on doing what you want, rather than just saying, I'll make something up from what I've got in my model.
Kind of. Yeah. More practical things are things like you could have an MCP that can contact GitHub using the GitHub API and touch and search files on GitHub or create a repo or create files in a repo. So rather than you creating a whole bunch of files locally and then doing a git commit and git push, it could just go directly into GitHub. That's the sound for an API being called. And it could just contact GitHub and directly do it itself. Now, the way that it works is you download or get the instructions for how to install or get the instructions for how to access MCPs. It's quite fast moving and they're all a little bit different. Some are written in Python, some are written in Node, some are remote APIs that you just need a URL and an API key for, right? So it's a little bit fast moving. And you have a config file for your AI thing and you list all the MCPs that you want to use. And within those MCPs, each one has one or more tools. So the GitHub one might have a create branch tool and the file system one might have a create folder tool and the documentation one might have a download latest PyPy documentation or whatever it might be. They have a list of tools that are accessed over a standard protocol, this MCP protocol, but it's essentially just the LLM requesting something and getting back a JSON blob, like the usual way in which two computer processes talk these days. I ask for something and it gives me back a JSON blob.
So as I understand it, the LLM, or rather LLMs that know about tool calling, can see what MCPs are configured, can see what tools are exposed, and when you ask them to do a thing, it infers, aha, right, I need to go and get an issue from GitHub. And it can see it has a tool called GitHub Get Issue. And it uses that. And the idea is the MCP kind of provides this deterministic way for the model to do certain things.
Right. Let's take, for example, that the GitHub one is a nice, relatable one. If I had the GitHub MCP enabled in my AI, then I could say, get all the issues for this project. And it would go and pull down a bunch of the issues for that project. I don't have to say, ask the GitHub MCP to do this. I just say in plain natural language, English, get all the issues. And it knows, because it's already introspected the MCP and it knows that the MCP has announced the tools that it provides. And so that's the general concept of what an MCP is. And I wanted to create one because when I'm creating new software, I want to make sure that I'm using up-to-date versions of libraries and toolkits, and I don't want to publish my software on GitHub with vulnerabilities in it, specifically dependencies that have vulnerabilities. And, you know, working for Anchor, we have a tool that can do this, which is Gripe. Now, I could create a Docker container, publish it, and then scan it with Gripe, but it would be much better if I did what they call shift left and on my workstation, run Gripe. Now, I ain't got time to type Gripe. What I can do is ask the LLM to scan my project to check that I'm not using any outdated, insecure things that have got CVEs in them. Now, you might think, well, if you're asking it, you could just type Gripe in the command line. Well, I could, but all of the modern AI LLMs have like a config document. So, for example, if you're used to using Claude Code, you'd have a file called claude.md. And in there, you give it instructions. And so I could say in there, before pushing to GitHub, always search for vulnerabilities in my code. I don't need to be more explicit than that. I don't need to say use Gripe. I could just say search for vulnerabilities. And if there was an MCP there that was Gripe, it would do that before I pushed my code to GitHub. And so it's like inserting useful parts of the development workflow where I might forget to do them. Like there's certain things I should do, and search for vulnerabilities is certainly a sensible one. There are others that I could introduce as well, like run something like SemGrep, and there is a SemGrep MCP that can search for security issues in your code. And so that was my goal, right, was to create a Gripe MCP. And so I use a tool called Typing Mind, which is like a web user interface, a bit like ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever, but it's highly configurable, like super highly configurable. Maybe Martin will talk about that one day because he's like the world's expert on Typing Mind. And I just asked it, like, can you create one? I've put the prompts in front of you guys in our show notes. Maybe I'll put them in the show notes as well, but they're a bit long. But I really did just say, like, hey, it'd be really good if we had an MCP that could scan my project for vulnerabilities. And it started creating one. It knew that there was an SDK for Python, so it would create a Python standalone project. And I wanted it to be nice and easy to use. So I wanted it to go and download the gripe binary for the user. So the user doesn't have to go and even have gripe installed. It'll go and get the binary and tell gripe to go and get the latest database of vulnerabilities and do all of that without you having to explicitly say, go and do those things, which you might feel you have to do if you were doing this manually. And so I spent like an hour during this meeting having a conversation with an LLM where it was getting exceptionally excited about the achievements that it was making as it went through. And it was like, yeah, we're really building a tool here, and like getting really fired up. And I need to like dial that down a little bit because that gets a little bit tiring after a while. But it eventually, by the end of the meeting, I had a thing where I could configure my AI to load this MCP. And then I could just say, scan this project, and it would do it. And it would create a list of CVEs, if there were any. And I could even say, explain that CVE, and it would go and interrogate the gripe database for me and tell me, like, what's the impact of that CVE? Should I care about it? Is my code likely going to be affected? Should I update the pattern? It even tells you, but it's even better than that. It doesn't, it tells you, you should update this dependency. So if I had like an old version of Pillow in Python, like, you know, Pillow version 9 or something, it would say, oh, you've got Pillow version 9 here. And then the LLM will say, ah, we should probably do pip install Pillow 11 or Pillow 12 or whatever the latest version is. And it knows what to do when the MCP comes back and says, here's the answer that they asked for, explaining the vulnerability. And the LLM knows, oh, okay, there's a vulnerability here. We should probably tell the user what to do. I didn't code that bit. I didn't have to code that bit. All I had to do was write the bit, well, get the LLM to write the bit, where it calls gripe, gives me the answers, explains the vulnerability, and then the LLM will then tell the human or will directly fix the issue. And that's the goal, really, is to make it easier to be up to date and to find the vulnerabilities and resolve them. And so the next day after the meeting, I packaged it up, got it in PyPy, I got it in Brew, and all of that, just from a 1 hour mini hackathon of myself, and I got it published, and now it's available, and there's documentation. You can find it. There's a link in the show notes. It's on the Anchor GitHub org. But I found it a really rewarding process to go from absolutely nothing. That thing did not exist before that day. And after 1 hour, an MVP existed. And the next day I had it published in PyPy and Brew, and I was super delighted, and I learned a load while doing it. So my next project will be even easier. So I'll put links in the show notes. Feel free to have a look and maybe write your own MCP server.
Your next project will be even easier and more secure.
That as well, yeah. Patch is welcome also, and issues. So yeah, I haven't tested it in every circumstance. So yeah, if you want to give it a go, feel free to file issues and let me know how it goes.